Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with executive editor of the paper, Bill Keller, about the history of the papacy.
It's a view of the popes kind of similar to what you would get if you were doing a history of the monarchy in England. The religious parts of it don't enter into it all that much.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Ava Gabrielson describes her long life with Stieg Larsson.
By all means, he was somebody and he had a reputation before millennium. So as being a good analyst, as being a good researcher, as being the one who just didn't slavishly look at things, but actually could see what would happen.
And Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news. For almost all of their extremely long history, the popes have been subjects of controversy and often curiosity. There's an important new book. It's called Absolute Monarchs by a major British historian, John Julius Norwich, and it's reviewed for us by a major American journalist, the great Bill Keller, executive editor of the paper and columnist, soon to become full-time writer, and he's here to talk about the book. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks.
All right. The popes are the leaders of the Catholic Church, yet the Vatican seems in some ways not always a strictly religious institution. How did that happen? How did it become such a kind of monarchy, as Norwich implies?
Well, I mean, they started out really as rulers of territory. For most of the 2,000 years or so that he covers in the book, it was Rome. A very different Rome. Much of it, the time, it was a sort of malarial swamp. And in fact, some of the popes died of malaria, and lots of cardinals and others, they dropped like flies from, you know, having to spend the summer in Rome. But at other times, the papacy was relocated to other places. The thing that Norwich does in this book, and it's a little startling if you were raised Catholic, is he treats these figures as rulers. As, you know, kings, sometimes generals, often diplomats, people jostling for territory, sometimes in league with emperors, sometimes in conflict with emperors and kings and Huns and, you know, other various tribes. It's a view of the popes kind of similar to what you would get if you were doing a history of the monarchy in England. The religious parts of it don't enter into it all that much.
Bill, something I was startled to see is just how many popes there have been through history. And they really create, you say, a kind of rogues gallery. Who are some of the really bizarre or worse popes we've seen?
Well, there are 265 of them that's the Vatican's official count. There are various other sort of pretenders and anti-popes and usurpers along the way. Norwich clearly realizes, as do journalists and playwrights and novelists, that the sinners are more entertaining than the saints. And there are clearly some good popes. It's not that they're all – it's just a litany of rogues. But you have popes who were lechers and popes who were nepotists and popes who were utterly corrupt, popes who did a bad job of advancing the cause that they were assigned to advance. I mean, who lost England, basically suffered a huge rift with orthodoxy so that they didn't even do a very good job of sustaining the power and perks of the church itself. Kind of my favorite, and one senses his favorite chapter in the book, has to do with a pope who didn't even exist, called Pope Joan, a figure of lore, although there are some serious historians who have attempted to make the case that she actually exists. This is in the mid-ninth century, an English woman, the story goes, an English woman who disguised herself as a man, kind of worked her way up through the curia and became pope and was only exposed when she gave birth to a child. The story is so good he can't resist giving her one of his 28 or so chapters and exploring it with his tongue a little bit in his cheek. And part of the legend is that after the church was fooled by this English woman, they devised a test for future popes to make sure they didn't get fooled again, which is that every candidate for the job had to sit in a chair that had a hole in the bottom of it, and a young deacon would be assigned to come up and grope the pope-to-be and announce to the assembled multitude, he has testicles.
Ouch! Bill, there are also some really serious controversies and at times scandals involving the church, some of them in recent times. What does Norwich have to say about the papacy during, say, the Second World War?
Well, the two main popes during the Second World War were Pius XI and Pius XII. He's hard on both of them. He faults them both for failing to speak up in defense of the Jews who were being slaughtered. He ends up being somewhat forgiving of Pius XI, who ultimately did speak up and condemned what was going on. But he's unforgiving of Pius XII, who, even when the trucks were rumbling through the streets of Rome, delivering the Jews of Rome to Auschwitz, said not a peep. He concludes that chapter by pointing out that Pius's successors put him up for canonization, and he said for Pius XII to be canonized would make a mockery of sainthood.
Bill, let me ask you a question about yourself as a writer, or something we're really proud of here at the Book Review is, while you have been executive editor, you have occasionally written major pieces for us. You are now going to become, in effect, a full-time writer for the paper. Will you approach that any differently from the way you did psychologically when you were in charge of this large and complicated newsroom? Are you freer now?
In some respects, I guess I am. I have a lot of license, but I also have developed a much greater respect for editors. One thing I've discovered just recently since I've started doing this occasional column for the magazine and have been edited again, I think I'm an easier edit now than I was in my early days when I resented anybody trying to tamper with my prose or question my ideas. I actually find it useful to have, I should be careful what I wish for, I guess, but I find it useful to have a critical foil and somebody who's going to tell me as a surrogate for the reader, this doesn't work or this isn't clear. You know, the last 8 years being executive editor will also have some influence on what I choose to write about. I do not plan to be the media columnist. We have a few of those, and nor do I want this to be the place where I settle scores, you know, from my time as executive editor. But I've been editor of the paper during a time when the whole industry went through a massive upheaval, and I think I've learned some things from that transition that will probably inform what I write about and what I have to say.
Thanks so much, Bill.
You betcha.
That's Bill Keller, executive editor of the New York Times, who reviews Absolute Monarchs by John Julius Norwich on the cover of this week's Book Review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So Julian Assange of WikiLeaks fame is becoming more enigmatic than ever. What's going on with this big book he was supposed to write?
Well, it was just 6 months ago that Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, announced that he had a huge book deal. He had signed a deal with Canongate in the UK and also with Knopf here in the US. And he had a total of $1.7 million in book deals and in foreign rights, which were huge. Now, this week, we are told that Julian Assange's book deal has fallen through. It was originally scheduled for publication in April of this year. Obviously, that date has come and gone. And now his publisher in the UK says that they're not quite sure when or if it will be published. And Knopf here says that it has been postponed indefinitely.
So does this have anything to do with Assange's other complications? I know that some legal issues he's facing. Did he give an explanation or did his publishers give an explanation for the postponement?
Well, Assange apparently has expressed concern to his British publisher that the memoir, which could be used against him by prosecutors in the United States. You know, when the book deal was first announced, Assange said that it would be, you know, a complete account of his life through the present day. It would include the founding of WikiLeaks and the work that he has done there. But he also said that he was very hesitant to write the book at all and that he was really just doing it for money.
In a case like this, Assange, obviously world famous, He's not really a writer, though. Was he supposed to be doing this book himself, or did he have a collaborator?
He was working with a ghostwriter, Andrew O'Hagan, a novelist, and apparently the book had been progressing quite nicely, that some of the work that had been done was good and that his publisher was encouraged. But it's not clear how much Assange was doing himself.
Do we think the book will eventually be written, or are the publishers themselves now concerned that Assange is not going to be as candid and forthright as they expected when they offered him all this money?
Well, Canongate in the UK says that they're not going to make any kind of statement about the book until next week. Assange is appearing in court in London to appeal against a ruling a couple of months ago that he should be extradited. So they're not saying definitively that the book will not be published, but they're also not sounding very optimistic, and they have not set a publication date.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Since his sudden death in 2004, Stieg Larsson has become one of the most famous and celebrated authors in the world. There's a new book about him by someone who knew him better than anyone else. It's called There Are Things I Want You to Know About Stieg Larsson and Me, and it's by Eva Gabrielsson, and I'm going to ask you right off the bat how we should actually pronounce your name in Swedish.
In Swedish, you'd say Eva Gabrielsson, but that's the Swedish pronunciation. If I myself would say it in English, I'd say Eva Gabrielsson.
Well, that'll work for us. This book is already getting a great deal of attention. It's been written about by my predecessor, Charles McGrath, in the New York Times, who edited the book review at one point. We have a strong, interesting review by David Carr, a celebrated media reporter and columnist here at the Times. Why is there so much fascination, first, with Stieg Larsson himself, and then with the life the two of you shared?
Well, I think the fascination, it stems from the Millennium books themselves. Seems like the alternate tale of Sweden here as being not quite the castle of everyone's dreams has caught on in many countries. They recognize the violence against women that's described, injustices, abuse of power, corruption, bonuses to company owners and boards of directors who maybe aren't doing very much and so on. So that's one thing that people recognize. But I think they take to the heart the heroes of the Millennium story, which try to fight these wrongs and these injustices, and they sort of identify with them. That's, I think, the base for it all. And afterwards comes the interest in the one who wrote it. And sadly enough, people recognize that he's dead.
Tell our listeners a little about your life together. You met when you were both quite young and stayed together for many, many years. Where and how did you meet?
We met at 18 in a northern small town called Umeå, north of Sweden. And I went to my first political meeting ever. It was a meeting against the Vietnam War. Stieg was there to greet the guests who were coming, and he was doing this in an unusual way. He had lots of social graces. So he was genuinely interested in people who were coming there, and especially in the new faces. So I came there with my kid sister, and he immediately saw that we didn't belong there. He hadn't seen us before. So he came up and said, "Hi, I'm Stieg. What's your name? Why are you here? What's your interest in being here?" And so on. Just started genuine interest, not just talking, you know. And that's how we met. And then he recruited me and my kid sister to the local group that was working against the Vietnam War, because we happened to live in the same area in that town. And he later on told me that he couldn't let this chance pass him by.
Not long ago, the great Norwegian novelist Per Pedersen visited us and told us also that antagonism toward the Vietnam War, the anger about that, motivated him in a political and ideological way. And it was a surprise to me. I hadn't realized just how much anger there was in Scandinavia about this particular war. And was it American military aggression? Was it the size of the superpower reaching across the globe? What was it in particular about the war in Vietnam?
First of all, I must say that the movement in Sweden was huge. I mean, there were hundreds of thousands of people who were involved.
Many students?
Students, but ordinary people as well, and old pensioners and so on, politicians, you name it. It's a whole wide range of the Swedish population. I mean, we were outraged at the attack on a small people. I mean, they were physically small as well, and the brutality of it. That's one part of it. But we also had a fond feelings for the American deserters and the ex-servicemen who ended up in Sweden, among other places. And we also met them during our travels in Europe, of course, because they were everywhere. And we saw what the war had done to them. We didn't want to see this unfold. And if you may remember, our then Prime Minister, Olof Palme, was also out on the streets marching against the war and created some kind. I think the U.S. withdrew their ambassador at the time, and we had no American ambassador for quite a while. And then some smart guy here had the idea, okay, we'll send an Afro-American ambassador, which they did, and see what would happen then if we could get Sweden to sort of stop being so critical. It didn't work at all. It was a very nice ambassador, though, that we got.
And that idea of Sweden is one that many Americans will have. In fact, we always heard when I was growing up about the great social democratic experiment in Sweden. But what you say in your memoir is that what seems to be a kind of violent dream landscape in these great Stieg Larsson novels is actually the literal truth. The things he describes are the Sweden of today. And what's it like? Neo-Nazis and all the rest. How did all this happen?
Slowly. Gradually, we were like the frog sitting in the cold water, slowly heating up. I mean, we were doing fine after the war. We weren't hit by the war. We could help build up Europe. So we made, Sweden did very well.
This is World War II you're talking about, after that war.
We weren't in the first one either, so yeah. We escaped both of them. So we were doing fine during the 50s, 60s and 70s, and then the financial difficulties came globally, but not at the scale we later saw. We saw the change in economy where we started losing our industries, the textile industries, some of the heavy industries, slowly the car industries. And this went on during the 80s, 90s and after the millennium. In that process also, people started to do things for themselves without really giving anything back. My sister says it's the I, me, and myself ideas that started to take root instead of what we thought we were as Swedes, hard working, getting up in the morning, looking out for your neighbor, fighting for justice, doing what you can to make a better life by actually working. Now the idea became more of, especially in the 80s when you had the dot-com companies, could start a company, build it up for a year or two, sell it off for millions, do something else. You could speculate on the stock market, make big money, and so on. And so there was a whole new thing coming. And in that process somewhere, we lost sight of what we were, what we were to do to build a society, not just try to get a quick fix and quick individual career.
And at what point amid all this, which will sound depressingly familiar to Americans because many similar things happened here, did Stieg Larsson then have the idea to write these novels that would capture this changing and corrupted world?
There was never any process of writing, thinking of writing anything about that. That's why I want to say in my book as well how it all started. Out of boredom, trying to figure out what an old man who receives flowers each year, who he is and why. This was a small text he had written. It's just a nice scene he had written in 1997, 5 years earlier. And he had nothing to do, so he wanted to explore that. And it sort of grew from there.
So it grew the way really all important novels do, out of the private idea, the images he had and his head. Now, what about the journalistic interests that he had as well? He was a prominent figure, a kind of crusader. How well known was he in Sweden before he began writing these novels?
He was well known for his knowledge of the extreme right in Scandinavia and well, he was well known in Europe. I mean, he was known among certain circles here in the United States as well. By all means, he was somebody, and he had a reputation before Millennium. So as being a good analyst, as being a good researcher, as being the one who just didn't slavishly look at things, but actually could, given all these facts, all these fragments, could see what would happen. That's his real strength, his analytical strength to make sense of not only what had happened, but also what was to come.
And you say also in the book that some of the work he was doing was not only controversial, but daring and bold, and put you both at some risk.
I had to describe it in the book because it explains a lot of why we weren't married and so on. But I must say that the risks that he and partly I faced because of his work since his public work, I should say, since 1983, writing for the British magazine Searchlight on the extreme right in Scandinavia, but also partly in Europe. The risks are the same as if you had a journalist who sort of focused on the mafia or Hell's Angels gangs and do that for 10, 20 years, then you are in trouble, then you are a target. So it's the same targeting of journalists that you see. Just happened that Stig's subject was the extreme right.
So death threats,
bullets,
physical threats, this kind of thing.
Physical threats, threats by phone. We had an answering machine, so the messages were recorded and given to the Swedish security police. We had ugly postcards coming in the beginning of the 1990s from Yugoslavia, where you had some Swedish extreme right-wingers who went down to fight as mercenaries because they wanted to. Yeah.
Now, something many readers admire in the Millennium series is the powerful women characters. Did you play any part in that? Were you a close reader or inspiration or muse for those characters?
I think I can't say. Actually, it would be better if Stig would answer that himself. But I can say that I wasn't surprised myself when I continually read the books as they evolved. That I wasn't. The portraits of the women didn't strike me as anything of the ordinary. I mean, they were like women we had around us.
And how about now? There's an ongoing suit. He left an enormous estate, and his family and you were in conflict. Is there any resolution approaching?
They broke off. Well, they finally agreed to have talks with me and my lawyer, and that was a year ago. We had two meetings, and they broke it off, so people think that I'm interested in getting hold of all this money. I think 50 million copies sold at least. It's a lot of money. It's at least 50 million euros. I don't know how much that's in dollars, but it's a lot.
It's a lot.
But I do have a paper trail since autumn 2005. What I've asked for is the right to manage, the legal right to manage the literary legacy, which also includes the political texts, for a fee, seen as some percentage which the family could choose themselves, for a percentage of the royalties. That's all I've asked. They could keep the bulk of the money, so.
Well, and many millions of readers will want to know if there is unpublished material that we can expect to see from Stig Larsson. Everyone asks if there is another novel. There are all sorts of rumors. Did he leave behind a substantial body of unpublished work that...
No, that's the problem. He wrote and he published what he had. I estimate that there's some 200 pages, a fragment of a fourth book, which, knowing how he wrote and seeing it and trying to lend a helping hand and eye now and then, I know that probably isn't in sequence either, but it's probably, as I said, as it all started, a scene, a nice scene, an old man receiving flowers. Mm. Probably like that, something might hang together and some things may not. But I think the readers of Millennium may have to do what I have done, accept the reality. He's dead.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Eva Gabrielsen, whose new book, There Are Things I Want You to Know About Stieg Larsson and Me, is reviewed in this week's Book Review. Jennifer Schuster is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
Tell me what's new on the list this week.
Well, the list seems to be settling into a kind of midsummer torpor, but we do have a few new books on the bestseller list, on the fiction list at least, one on the top and one on the bottom. James Patterson, the thriller writer who dare not speak his name, is back at number one with his latest. It's called Now You See Her, co-written with Michael Ledwidge. And there's a new book down at number 15, the last spot on the list. It is called The Hypnotist, and it is by the mysterious Swedish crime writer Lars Kepler.
Lars Kepler? Who's he?
Well, Lars Kepler is a pseudonym for a husband and wife novelist duo. Their real names are Alexander and Alexandra Coelho Anderil. And this book was a huge hit in Sweden back in 2009 when it was first released. And it was known to be published under a pseudonym, and it sort of set off this frenzy in Sweden to figure out who had actually written it. Newspapers ran computer analyses of parts of the text. They opened a tip hotline for readers to call in. Well-known writers like Henning Mankell had to issue formal denials that they had actually written it. And then finally, two tabloid reporters with a sort of Stieg Larsson complex tracked down this couple. Their names are Alexander and Alexandra Coelho Anderil. They were tracked down at their isolated summer cottage in the middle of the night. The reporters came with flashlights and knocked on the door, forced them to acknowledge their literary guilt, which the couple did in a big press conference back in Stockholm. So there's just something about Swedes and kind of grisly crime thrillers with complicated authorship. You know, as you recall, there have been sort of frequent rumors that Stieg Larsson actually sort of co-wrote his book with his partner. So now you got these two.
Jenny, I'm very weak on science, but the name Kepler rings a bell.
Kepler was the great astronomer, and one clue in this whole affair was that Alexandra Coelho Anderil had previously written a historical novel about Kepler's friend and fellow astronomer, Tycho Brahe.
What about nonfiction?
No new titles on the nonfiction list, and in fact, most of the books on the nonfiction list have been there for more than a month, starting with Laura Hillenbrand's Unbroken, which is still at number one in its 33rd week on the list.
Wow.
Talk about Unbroken. One relatively new title is Miracle of Freedom by Chris Stewart and Ted Stewart. As you recall, this is a book that Glenn Beck has really been out there touting. It's sort of from a small publisher to relatively unknown writers, and this thing has just been surging. It was on the extended list a few weeks ago. Last week it was number 11. This week it's number 5. So Glenn Beck and his big thumbs up has got some life in it.
Well, as John Updike might say, Beck is back. Thank you, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.